the University of Washington Computer Science and Engineering Distinguished Lecture Series.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's my pleasure to introduce Marty Hurst, who is going to give a talk I'm really looking forward to on search interfaces. Marty got, I think, all of her degrees at UC Berkeley, and then did a short stint at Xerox PARC before going back and joining the faculty at UC Berkeley. She's won lots of awards, can't list them all, but ACM Fellow and a Career Award, and we're really lucky to have her here. So go for it.
Okay, great. It's really an honor and a pleasure to be here back in Seattle. It's a beautiful town, and this is a really happening department. That's what I put on my webpage highlights when I said I was going to be here. It's just a lot of excitement, and I feel like I'm getting the VIP treatment here, so thanks to everybody who's meeting with me. I really appreciate it. I've been asked to reprise the keynote talk I gave at SIGIR, the Information Retrieval Conference by ACM, this year, so that's what I'm giving. I call it Seeking Simplicity in Search User Interfaces, just because I like the alliteration. But I think a better title might be Seeking Clarity, because really we want to go for clarity. So why am I showing this image? This is a piece of art, actually, that you can see in Rockefeller. I don't know if it's still there, actually, but it was there this summer in Rockefeller Center. It's a piece of art by the artist Jeff Koons. And in a way, it gives a feeling, the essence of simplicity. It's a childhood rocking horse that he remembers from when he was a kid, and it's made of very simple flowers, marigolds and the like. And when you look at it, it gives you this feeling of joy and happiness and sort of simplicity. But it was anything but simple to make this piece of art. And, you know, he had a lot of attendants and helpers. You know, he did not thread every flower himself to give you this impression of simplicity. You know, and he's probably made many different sketches and designs before coming up with this final execution. The other thing, though, about this image is that it was really simple for me to take this picture and upload it to a PowerPoint slide. I took this photo when I was in New York City on my smartphone, emailed it to myself, and just stuck it on a slide. And 10 years earlier, it would have been really hard to do this. And in fact, we had a memorial for my dear colleague, Seth Teller, who passed away recently. And we were remarking about how in graduate school, you know, we didn't have a lot of photos of that time because it was actually much harder to take photos back then. So we didn't have the photos that you would have today from that time. So things have become much simpler. It's been much simpler to accomplish certain kinds of tasks than it was in the past. So the genesis, though, of this talk, besides being asked to give a keynote talk, was actually the germ of the idea behind this talk was that I was asked to write an article, or invited to write an article, for the special issue of IEEE Computer on collaborative information seeking. And so, I mean, it was reviewed, and if I hadn't written something good, it wouldn't have gotten in, but I was challenged to think of what to write about for this. And so what I wrote about was that the research shows that people want to collaborate when they search. It's shown by all of the qualitative research that's done, but unfortunately, the tools aren't there. It's not working right now. There aren't any good interfaces for collaborative information seeking. So the question is, why haven't collaborative search user interfaces caught on yet? And when you think about that, more generally, why do any search user interfaces catch on? You know, really, still today, web search interfaces look pretty much the same as they did 10 or even 20 years ago. So we have some very tough search challenges. We have some very tough user interface challenges generally. But sometimes these search challenges seem like an impenetrable wall of ice, and we'll never get anywhere with them. But then, sometimes with the right combination of factors, there's a stunning breakthrough that happens, and something emerges through that wall of ice that you're just like, oh, why didn't I think of that? There's a breakthrough that happens. And what I want you to think about through this talk is, for a problem that you haven't solved yet, what combination of factors can happen that you haven't considered in a while that might be a way to break that ice down and find a solution. So, in other words, how can we make the next search blockbuster? So There have been a few big search blockbusters in the past, so we can argue that Google Web Search circa 1991 really radically changed the landscape or the ice scape of search at that time, and there were a few things that they did differently. First of all, people had given up on search. They thought it was a solved problem or it was just not going to get any better. It was a portal, and it was a combination of looking at how did people link web pages and having a simple user interface that made a change there. Faceted navigation for like-item search, which I will talk about in a little bit, was a major change in interfaces that's become really widely adopted. Auto-suggest for helping with the vocabulary problem where you don't know what the right thing is to say, which we see now very widely used in search user interfaces. I would argue that news search, like we've seen on Google News and now adopted elsewhere, really was a fundamental change in how we do search and consume news more generally. And you can argue whether or not map navigation is search, but that certainly has changed from the original web online web tools. It's changed for the better in a very significant way. So I call these past search blockbusters. So now I'm going to summarize the main points of my talk, and then I'll elaborate on them, but I guess you can leave right after this, but you'll miss a lot of good pictures. So stay for the pictures. So the talk summary is, what makes for a successful new search experience? And for those of you who do not do user interfaces or search, I hope this talk is still relevant for the following reasons. It should give you some ideas about how to choose research problems generally, and it shows where your technical skills might be needed for search, even if you don't work on search or UIs generally. So often a problem seems unsolvable, and then suddenly somebody solves it. And they solve it, though, by taking a really simple approach. So that's kind of the point I'm trying to make. So how? So three key factors that I'm focusing on. There's other ways to solve problems. But the factors that I'm focusing on are framing a need in the right way for users. Not in the right way for your research interests, but the right way for users. Having the right technical and social factors in place. In other words, the ecosystem has to be right, so sometimes you are too early. And simplicity, which is actually what I really mean, is usability, can be key for massive adoption. So I'll define some of these terms, sort of. So what do I mean, first of all, by succeed? My definition of success for the purposes of this talk is, say, approximately at least 70% of the people who have that need, that information need, that problem, use the solution. And about 80% of the time that they use that solution, they either enjoy it or they don't notice it. Like, it works well for them. They don't use it because they have to necessarily, but it works well for them. So that is a solved problem in my world. So now, what do I mean by solving the real problem? So here I have an illustration of a problem that was solved that probably nobody had. So why does a user need a giant spoon in the middle of a pond with a cherry balanced on it? Well, they probably don't, but it's kind of cool. And so the point is that so often in research, we build a giant spoon with a cherry balanced on the top. And it's really shiny, and it looks pretty neat. But actually, nobody needs that. They really don't need it. But you know, you did get a good paper out of it, and it's neat. But we don't frame our problem in a way that makes the most sense to users. And in fact, when I gave this talk at SIGIR, I had earlier been talking to somebody, and they'd said, oh, you know, I was going to do like this 3D user interface. Oh, this was after I gave the talk. This 3D user interface, you know, ranking the results in 3D. Is that what you were talking about? And I'm like, oh, yes, actually, that was the cherry on the spoon. And and before the talk, I was talking to someone. They're like, oh, I'm working on this interface. I'm working on this tool. It's like for listing Yellow Pages results, and the users just don't get it. They're just not liking it. I'm like, well, what are you doing differently than the other Yellow Pages listings, and why is it better for the users as opposed to what you're doing? And they couldn't give me the answer, and it was the cherry on the spoon. So anytime you are devising a new tool that's going to be used by people as opposed to maybe under the hood for something or whatever, think about this image and see if it's that. And I know, versus not. Ask yourself that question. Burn it into your mind. All right. And this is at the Walker Art Museum in Minneapolis. All right. So, okay, so the next point is usability or simplicity. And there's lots of guidelines, and you people here in this room teach this topic, but I'm going to boil it down to three different points that we want to keep in mind when aiming for usability or simplicity in tools that we make for users. One thing we need to do is test and revise, because most of the time we don't get it right the first time. Even Steve Jobs fought the idea of an iPad. You know, apparently his in-law, his brother-in-law kept saying, you should make a slate sort of thing. And Steve Jobs is like, that's a terrible idea. And then his brother-in-law bothered him so much that he finally made an iPad. So he didn't even actually know it was a good idea until his annoying in-law told him it was a good idea. So we should test and revise until we get something that's right. We want to design for flow, and details really matter. And I'm going to illustrate these three points with pictures. So first of all, when we think about testing and revising, we can think about a space, a design space. And what we want to do is find, you know, the channel in the bottom. But often when we first design, we end up at one of these spiky points, or maybe in one of the little channels in the middle. And we really have to test. We have to just put a design out there. If you're more experienced, you probably start in a better part of the design space than if you're less experienced. And if you're really junior, you're probably going to start in a more interesting part of the design space than somebody old like me who has these older ideas. But you have to revise, try it with users. You don't have to do some big formal study. Something quick and dirty with just a few people to get their response. Now, I know what you're thinking, some of you in the audience. You're thinking, I'm sure I'll find your interface intuitive, that you're going to show this to people and they're going to give you a look in the eye like this, that you don't want to show what you're doing to real users. It's a pain. It's annoying. You have to talk to people. It's really hard. You have to deal with IRBs. But it's really not that much harder than a lot of the other stuff that we do when we are doing computer science. It's really just another thing that we do. Like, you have to, I don't know, test your code, or you have to, you know, get the stuff to compile. I mean, there's a lot of things that we do that's really hard in computer science. It's really not that hard if you design it from the very beginning, if you plan from the start to have people try it. It's actually kind of fun, because when it's working well, then it's a great feeling. So another thing we have to do is listen. So the thing is, when you show your design to that goat and the goat says something, often what I've found is, you know, I've taught students a lot, and they have their designs in the class, and then they want to hear something, and then they hear this other thing, and they don't listen to it. And so when I review the logs of what the user said, I'll see that the user said a couple of interesting things, and that's the clue for where the great design is in their design space. But the students wanted to hear all this other stuff, and they just ignored that clue that's over here on the side that's really the way to go forward. And I'm like, look what your users told you that you're not listening to because it's not the thing you wanted to hear. That is the answer. That is going to be your solution. So the real key thing is to not have a lot of assumptions about what the answer is. Don't look for the cherry on the spoon. Really just be open to lots of different things. So there's a lot of there's research by Stephen Dow and others that show that if you have students do multiple designs in a UI class, they have to do, say, three designs in parallel and iterate over all three, they actually end up with better outcomes than if they have one design and iterate on that design. Part of it is that the students don't get so hung up on one design and kind of, you know, get attached to it and get really wedded to that design and feel like personal ownership of the design. It's just like when they do these psychological studies where they have some pens, they're all identical, they lay the pens out on the table and they ask the participants to choose a pen. So they choose one of the pens, and then they can exchange it for another pen, and people are like, no, that's my pen. I like this one now. It's my pen. You know, people get really attached to something after they've made a choice. But you really have to step away from that tendency and try to be open to what people are telling you, because often you've got a germ of a good idea in there, and you need to follow up. That's iterating and testing. And now details. So this is a very unlikely product for me to highlight, but I tried this. I had to clean my Mac because my Mac was low on disk space, and I downloaded this Clean My Mac product, Clean My Mac 2. And what I loved about this product is that it had all these, it's really not what most people want to do in their spare time, is clean up the disk space on their Mac. But this product has to walk people through a kind of a complicated process. It asks a lot of questions about which part of your system's files do you want to delete, and so on and so forth. And so they've made this very beautiful user interface for walking people through the process of cleaning their Mac. So I could like use this product all day long. And so I actually have a videotape of some of this, how this product works. And what I love about it is the details that of the interactivity, the little tiny bits of animation to draw the user's attention to the different choices, and the way it's broken down the problem of the different tasks in cleaning your Mac. And imagine if instead of this was a Clean Your Mac app, this was an application to help you do a very complex, rich search task. So here's Clean My Mac 2 in action. And I don't have any audio. I'm just showing the different things. So this is getting you started. And I'm walking through the different main tabs here. So there's system cleanup, and you've got a little vacuum cleaner. There's large and old files. There's iPhoto cleanup, trash cleanup, so on. So each one has a different look. Now here, see the little arrows showing you where the different choices are. And then there's Extensions Manager. So I just did the overview of the different things. Now we're going to go back to the top, and we're going to start cleaning my Mac. So it's showing you here. Here's where you start. Here's some other stuff I'm pointing out. OK, here, let's get started. And even the details here about how far it's processed, it's just so clear what's going on. It's sort of showing you some other information to distract you from the fact that it's taking a while to process the files. And now that's a little unnecessary, but so there's a little bit of verbiage to try to distract you some more. But you can see how far along it's gone. OK, I think I'm going to cut that so we don't watch the whole. Oh, yeah, now it's giving some more details while you're waiting about the other things that you can clean up, educating you about this, like I said, very kind of sophisticated, complicated program. All right, so now I'm showing some other things. It's giving you some options. And again, it's trying to be both, entertaining, but informative at the same time. Here's some details about what it got done. Now there's this whole thing about language files that are available that are to be removed from the Mac and so on. So again, imagine instead of cleaning the Mac, this was showing you different options for how to search over different languages for an educational website, if it was details about how to look in a digital library catalog, for example, that has lots of different sections. You can imagine it would be a lot more effective than what we typically see. But we don't see that in our search user interfaces. And I'm wondering, why not? Why is it only in this prosaic application to clean your Mac? It seems like we could just do a lot better. Next topic is something that's talked a lot about in user interface design, which is flow. And so flow is the idea that as you're doing your work, you're not interrupted in what you're doing. So this is kind of famous illustration of flow, which is that as you're doing your work, you're challenged just the right amount. So you feel that your skill is being used, and you're being challenged, but not so much that you feel anxiety. And so you want to remove friction so your things aren't getting in a way that are unnecessary. So you're not hitting dead ends, for example. The system isn't going too slowly, for example. There's scent if you're doing search, so you know where to go next, even if you have to do a lot of searching and drilling down. You feel oriented. You have structure to show you like what categories are available if you're doing a very complex search. And fast response time is often very important for flow. I'm now going to show an example of failed flow when things get bogged up. I'm going to do a little case study about a lot of these things not working well in the search user interface. So this is an example of something where people haven't thought about it a lot. And this example is in the problem of saving documents. So this is the PubMed. I hope those of you in the back can see this decently. This is a website that's usually very good, the PubMed search interface for searching bioscience articles. What I want to do, though, is I want to save documents that I've found that are useful, which people that are doing scholarly work often want to do. And I've selected a few documents, and now I've got the drop down, and I want to save it. So I click the Send To, And then I'm clicking on collections, and then it has me click add to collections. So now I've got this new page, and it says, okay, create new collection or append to existing collection. Now I click create new collection. It asks me to give it a name. I'm giving it a name, calling it tamoxifen, because those were tamoxifen articles. I'm clicking save, and now it says, okay, your collection was saved. Now you can edit it. All right, now I want to go back to my search, but there's no way to go back, so I have to type my query again. I type the query again, and now I don't see the ones I saved marked specially. So I'm going to add some more documents to the collection. I'm just picking the first couple rather arbitrarily. And I'm now going to save those. So again, I have to do send to, select collections, go to add to collections. It doesn't remember what I had before. It's got the page there. Now I have to go just drop down and do tamoxifen, do send, there's do save. And then it starts again. Now I have to go do my query again. So this was very poor flow because it's taking me out of what I was doing. It's making me repeat a lot of commands and so on. So even though PubMed is generally a well-designed tool, they really didn't pay attention to saving documents, which is generally something that's been overlooked a lot in search user interface design. A better example is done by WorldCat, which also you see has faceted navigation, which we'll talk about, it's still a very standard interface, but they've paid more attention to flow. So here, I search on nanotechnology, say. It's just books, not articles in this case. But I select a couple of the documents. There's a lot of repetitions here, but say that there aren't. So now I can do save to, make a new folder here. So I'll give it a name, nanotech. And if I create new list, it goes ahead and creates it after a moment. And there, it's doing it on the same page. I'm back to where I was. So that's much better flow. And I can now select some more documents. And if I do that, it's going to give me the choice right on this page. So my flow is working nicely. There it is. All right, very good. So much better design. So that's a very standard interface. What if we want to get a little fancier? So I did a little work for the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and there people are on the clock. People have to look through hundreds of thousands of articles. They have to find one or two that are really relevant for a given very complex query. They actually want to use, they don't want to use the mouse if they don't have to, so they want to just select a few relevant documents, organize them into groups, name those groups because they're going to use them to write up a legal case. So we did a little work on what would actually be a good design for them. They actually write very long, complex Boolean queries. So they want a lot of other fancy things. I don't know if this is going to actually show up very well here. I think maybe you're not seeing the video might be hidden here. So hold on. Let me just fix this slide. A new slide. Let me just project that. So the query is actually very structured. The results need to have every term highlighted. But the idea here is as the user finds documents that are relevant, they use keyboard commands to select, using just a single letter, to place documents into different categories, which they're then going to name later. So they'll do a triage step where they find relevant documents. When they feel they've found enough relevant documents, each one going into a different group marked by us spatially and with a color, they'll then rearrange those documents in order to build a case around them. So we'll see that in a moment. So now it's easy to, a normal everyday user of document search isn't going to want to do something this elaborate, so this is tailored to a more specialized, intense analyst kind of a user, but these with very detailed user research, we found that these particular users want to, they really care about the order in the group that the documents are shown. If the document's at the top, That means it's a more important document. They're probably going to use it first in the case. They want to be able to collapse it down and see different kinds of metadata in the documents. They want to be able to reorder them, move them into different groups, name the groups according to how they're going to use it in the legal case, and then create new groups to reorganize the documents and so on. So it's a different interface for a different kind of need. But with intense user research, it was found that this sort of interface, at least qualitative research found that this was highly preferred over other options. I mentioned faceted navigation earlier, and those of you who know my research would be familiar with this. If you've shopped online, used a library catalog online, et cetera, you'll be familiar with this layout. The idea is that for like items, so images, products, anything where you have a collection, not the whole web, but you have a collection of similar things, you want to be able to navigate them, search them, according to many different metadata attributes. This has become kind of the standard way to do it. But this came out of our research, the Flamenco Project, primarily. The idea was on the web, as I'll talk about it, but we regularized it, systematized it, gave some kind of theoretical foundations behind it, and did the usability studies to show that this was the way to go, that people understood or didn't get lost, even if they didn't fully understand what was going on under the hood, to allow people to slice and dice and see query previews for, say, in this case, art history. I'll show a demo in a moment. The idea behind this, though, was actually our original, this is a slide from the original proposal for this work, is we wanted to have a good interface for image collections, e-government sites, shopping sites, and digital libraries. This is actually was the goal I started with, and actually it's come to be that it is the standard interface for searching all of these things, navigating all of these things. But actually, when I wrote the career grant proposal, my true motivation was I needed to teach a course, our intro course, and I needed to cover website search. And at the time, the only work on website search was this article by Jared Spool called Why On-Site Searching Stinks. That was it. And he had this one little graph showing that you were better off not having search. This is without search versus with search. You were slower. You were less 6% of successful tasks. You were more successful if there wasn't any search on your site than if there was search on your site. This is back around 99. And so it's like worse than nothing. That's how bad it was back then. And I was supposed to teach how to do a search on websites. So that was kind of grim. And I had done some work on trying to bring categories into search, and I did this work at Xerox PARC, and we did put it in this 3D thing, and I knew it wasn't right to do it in 3D, but that's what we had budget for. This was with karate, and so we did it. And I'd done other work in bringing multiple categories into navigating documents, but it was ahead of its time. We'd done it, my dissertation was before the web, and so I showed main topics and subtopics and how to put that into interfaces, but it wasn't realistic at that time. But now it's 99, and I need to teach a practical approach for the web. Fortunately, by this time, dynamic web pages for the web had become standard. But how people were using them was a mess. And my claim was hierarchical faceted metadata could be made understandable if done right. And what I mean by this is faceted means you have multiple orthogonal categories describing the same thing. Brand and color and price describing products. Media, like watercolor and oil painting, plus artist, plus size describing art, works of art, etc. And hierarchical, these things are organized in hierarchies. But how to make it so it's understandable and people don't feel lost and people know where to go next. And you can integrate search. So, what was around? Well, Yahoo Directory circa 2001. I went to Yahoo and gave this talk. It was a mess. So let's try to find UC Berkeley from the top. So if you go to the top and try to navigate to UC Berkeley at that time, you would see these choices. Education or region. So if you pick college and university, then you would get this. So now you can pick colleges and universities. It switches you to home education, colleges and universities. There's a lot of symbolic links. Then it kind of turns into this other thing. So now you've got to pick a region, the United States. And then you drill down, then you get this alphabetical list, and then or you have to choose public or private. So now you can see, if you look at the link at the top, it keeps changing from one thing to another. So we have now it's suddenly turned into United States, California Education, College and University Public Campuses. So this is the point, is that the breadcrumb changes radically. You start by picking certain categories, and the path is changing dynamically under your feet. And what I was really advocating for was stability in letting people know the categories they're picking and combining them in a way that made sense. Everything was dynamic and kind of insane in terms of what happened when you picked categories. So you keep going, and finally you get to Berkeley after doing this strange thing. And you have to know if it's public or private and so on. So I'm like, you really have to separate these into the different groupings that make sense. Let people know it's education, then let them combine it with region. Stop the insanity. If you look at other things that were around, there's an REI example from 2001 where, they sort of tried to do it, but things were really a mess. And these were the best examples I could find at the time. So they would have these different sports on the side, camping, climbing, cycling, paddling. But then, you pick camping, hiking, and then you get this sort of subcategory, shop, all, camp, hike, learn, and share. But then do you do that with climbing, too? I mean, and then you get this other stuff here, other camping and hiking, like tents and field gear. But then does that apply to climbing, too? It's like you're getting all these weird cross products. It's just unclear where to go. And if you do click on backpacks, then you're suddenly in this other world here. It doesn't have anything to do with that thing on the side. There's internal frame, and then there's youth models. And what about kids somewhere else? And then if you search, all bets are off. Suddenly there's this other camping, hiking, books, padding, travel. It's just some other part of the information architecture kicks in. And the top categories are this other thing entirely. That was the state of categories in search and their integration at the time. It was just very confused. If you click on learn and share, then it all changes to something else over here. And so on and so forth. So what we wanted to do was give some regularity to this, give people, figure out how to do all this right so that there's a systematic way to design these websites. So we did a whole lot of studies. We started with the target population, architects and city planners. We did a needs assessment. How do they want to look at their images? Interviewed them, did contextual inquiries, did some lo-fi prototyping, paper prototyping, showed paper prototype to just three people. My student, who's an architect, was really worried that they were going to want only pictures and no metadata. She was like, they're not going to want the metadata. They're not going to want to see text. She was wrong. They were like, give us more metadata. Did a design, did a study, simple interactive version. They liked the metadata. Did another design, another study. We developed four different designs. I had a disagreement with my students. I wanted this, what ended up becoming our design. They didn't, so we stuck my design at the very end. And actually, that was the one where people were like, no, I like that thing that you haven't fully implemented. Please do that. And so we did. We also revised the metadata to make it better, et cetera. And then we did comparison studies. And the matrix view, which is the final design, is the one that started working well. Did another design. And we got very positive responses. Now we're in the right part of the design space. Then we're like, OK, we've kind of worn out the architects. We're going to get a new collection and a new population to go with it. This time it's art history. And we have the Fine Arts Museum collection from San Francisco. And we're going to do another study and another metadata system. And now we're going to compare it to a Google-like baseline. The only problem was that the Google-like system was an order of magnitude faster than our experimental system. Oops. Oh, well. It didn't matter because our design was so much better that people preferred it, even though it was much slower. And that's where we came up with this. Oh, that rejected from Sigar was for the Sigar talk. So it was published in Kai. So the highest cited paper from that year of Kai. And this is now, it's still actually functioning demo on our website. And let me show now I have, this is a video of not just this flamenco design on Nobel images, but actually how it's been interpreted over the years, now 10 years or more, by many other websites as well. So We use this Nobel Prize winners. It's sort of cheating because it's more of a database than a text collection, but here you see years, prizes, and countries. And now we started with who's won the economics prize. They're all men, at least up to this point. Now we organize by the country and the state that they come from. Now we can drill down into just California, and it's hierarchical, so now it's where in California are they from. So it's still a little fancier than the faceted designs that we see today because we have this hierarchy within the grouping. Now you can drill down and see the metadata organized hierarchically as well. And you see that the two facets are broken, affiliation and prize, into the two pieces of the breadcrumb with the X's, which you see as the standard representation on websites today. We also had a little history thing. Now we're going to expand. We also allowed you to expand by removing constraints. And the thing is that the key thing here is even though we're doing conjuncts of disjuncts with database queries, users didn't have to fully understand the underlying model in order to not feel lost. And that was really important for this design. Also, you couldn't do ORs within a category, and people kept asking us about that. And I'm like, well, why do you think we need that? Do you want it? They're like, no, but other people might. And that's another really important principle for usability design. This sort is don't trust what people say other people want, only what they themselves want. Because people aren't good at guessing what somebody else wants, but they're very good at knowing what they themselves want. So now we're looking at US prizes, and there are women and men across different prizes, chemistry, economics, medicine, physics, and so on. We have tool tips to show the hierarchy underneath a given category. Now we'll do search within to show how to contextualize the search among the categories. So I'm searching for California within all items. So we worked a lot about how do you show the hits within the metadata and highlighting and so on. Okay, now I'm showing Amazon's use of faceted navigation. And I met the engineer who was responsible for converting the back end, and he told me it took them years to make it like Flamenco because he was in charge of doing it because their infrastructure wasn't originally designed to work this way. And this is WorldCat again. This is the big library catalog, the unified library catalog across different libraries. And what I really like is when people get the topics. That's the key part to me, not so much the other metadata, but when you try to get the topics faceted, because that's where I think the real payoff comes. So here, I searched on information retrieval, and then I'm drilling down into law. So we get the conjunction of law and information retrieval, and it turns out there's a bunch of books and papers on that topic. And then I can drill down even more and find books on, multimedia and law and information retrieval and some other subcategories like psychology. And so we're getting some really cool stuff. I guess it's just psychology and information retrieval. We got rid of the law. Okay. All right, Yelp had this interesting, it was following eBay put the horizontal facets that allow you to add or remove some subset, and then Yelp actually continued with that with the OR. And then people have gotten kind of fancy with kind of more flowing UIs that are pretty and more creative kinds of multimedia sorts of fields and so on, like with this. I don't know that you don't really have to have these crossovers, but I guess they're entertaining. So it's good for a visual thing for the public to look at a museum's catalog and so on. So we did a lot of testing and revising, as I made clear. This interface supports flow. People didn't feel like they were lost. They don't get a lot of empty results, which was a real problem with web search interfaces at that time, especially site search. And we really paid a lot of attention to details with text and search. It's really easy for the page to look cluttered, so you have to work a lot on the fonts and contrast and white space so it doesn't look cluttered. And a lot of people build faceted interfaces that look bad, and so it's really hard to, people don't want to use them if they're cluttered. Now it's really standard. It's built into a lot of the Apache tools, so you can just use Elastic or whatever off the shelf and have it look good. But what's really important is it solved the real problem. People needed to do web search like items. But also the ecosystem was ready. When I was first working on this, it just wasn't working. Stuff the websites wouldn't support it, the items weren't available, and so it wasn't ready. And but also the simplicity was there. People kept wanting us to put, you know, saying we should do really complex Boolean stuff, worrying about ranking and putting bars in and so on, all these things that actually people didn't care about. You listen to the users, they tell you what matters to them, and that's what leads to a success. So that said, I think faster navigation is on the way out. So here was an example from a book I had. Someone was looking at somebody's book about faster navigation. They had this example, find your VW. And they have this beautiful faster navigation tool for picking a VW. And I went to this website to take a look at it. And what did I see but this? Everything's iPadified. And I don't know. I guess they magically know what I want. I want a red Beetle or something. I think this there's a lot less metadata. There's a lot fewer choices. And I think it's maybe the rise of the behavioral data mining approach to search design now, where basically, they feel they know everything about you, and they're just going to surface exactly what you want to see, and you have a few choices, and you scroll through them really fast. That seems to be the way people are designing browsing e-commerce sites today. I'm not quite sure what I think about that, except for it seems to be the way it's going. So perhaps that's the future. Okay, so how to get blockbuster UIs, at least for search? A real need is being met, the technical and social ecosystem is ready, and the design is usable. But I started this with this question about collaborative information seeking and saying that there seems to be a need for it, but nobody's solved the problem. People want collaborative search. Our friends at Microsoft Research have done all these studies that show that. So what's going on? Researchers have designed tools that reflect the stated needs. People say they want to share information and so on. There's To Search Together by Morris and Horowitz that does all the stuff that people want. You know, there's these other tools, Team Search and Cogmento by people. But you know, they're not being adopted. Why not? Well, I think because there's not enough additional value in these for people to adopt them to justify switching to the specialized tool. There's friction. I think the usability issues aren't resolved. And so people are satisficing with what they have, with email, with social media, sharing tools. OK, yet I think there's hope. Why do I think there's hope? Well, because there's been recent prominent successes in other closely related problems, long-standing problems of coordination and collaboration. Small group meeting coordination, and large-scale idea commenting and editing. Both of these are notable to me because I've observed master's students trying to solve them and not quite succeeding. So the most important precedent is informal meeting scheduling. So what do I mean by this? The success of Doodle. So it was founded in 2007, and now it has more than 20 million users per month, at least it said so in January 2014, according to the company. One Doodle poll is made every 2 seconds, they claim. So in my HCI class in 2005, some really smart students, including one who's a professor in Michigan, tried to solve this problem. And they made a pretty good UI where you try to, you know, you'd schedule the meetings. And you know, it didn't quite make it. They called it Vern. It was almost there, but you know, it just wasn't easy enough to use. It just was a little too cumbersome. You know, we couldn't put our finger on why it wasn't right, but you know, it was clear. It just wasn't easy enough, and it was too burdensome. But you know, you look at Doodle, and it's just so easy. You know, you just—I've sped it up. But you know, if you want to make an event, you just say you name it, and you pick a few days in the calendar. You go next. You just pick a few times. All right, just gonna make a few times here, a few time slots. And you know, you can expand it out, and then you send it to a few people. There's the poll is done, and all you have to do is invite some people by email. Put your name, and if you put your name, then you can see who else is there. So I pick a few times that are good for me. Actually, I put Jamie's name down here. And the brilliant thing here is it's so easy for somebody. You just put your name, you don't even have to log in, and you can see what other people, what times other people have chosen. And you're already building your consensus or seeing if you're not going to build it. And it's very clean, very simple. So this was actually an earlier version of Doodle, and they've continued to refine it. This is the UI today. So this solves a previously unsolved but very, very common collaboration problem in a very simple manner. I don't know about you, but I was emailing people. We were all sending emails around until Doodle came around. You know, how many of you were sending emails to your colleagues? Let's arrange a time to have this meeting, and you had email around email around email, and you don't do that anymore now, right? Because you have this. If you're in an organization where everybody's on the same calendar, you don't have to do it. But if you're not, you know, use a pool like this. This, to me, this was an unsolved problem, completely unsolved coordination collaboration problem until this tool came along. And now it's solved for millions of people. It's solved. So that's why I'm optimistic. It is such a simple problem, such a simple solution to a difficult collaboration problem. And it was sitting there in front of our faces. Anybody could have come up with this design, but they didn't. My students didn't, I didn't. Somebody did. Somebody else did. And it was a lot of simple changes that were key, like not requiring a login, just put your name there, just send the email invite, have a flexible way to put the dates, not having to mark some giant calendar, small, simple, tiny differences that made the collaboration work. So, previously, there was no solution to the problem of thousands of people commenting on ideas. But now, IdeaScale and Stack Exchange really work well. These amazingly good databases are out there for solving programming problems. I don't know about you, but my students, the younger ones, they don't know how to program without Stack Exchange. But that thing didn't exist before. It's very new. It's only been out a few years. And it works so well to make high-quality discussions without spam, without flames, about programming questions. It's very new technology, and it's user interface technology. There's no sophisticated, computer science, right? It's all user interfaces, 100% user interfaces. And learning management systems. I don't know if you guys have used Canvas here, but I love it. And, all these other ones before it were terrible, terrible. Blackboard, awful. And now I can do all this stuff. I can have all these interactive tools with my students. We call it B courses at Berkeley, using this fantastic learning management tool. It's beautifully designed. I couldn't have designed it anywhere near this well. And I thought, nobody can make a good learning management system until this thing came along. It's open source too, by the way. So maybe collaborative search is just around the corner. And in fact, my colleagues made this OSNAP tool. It's got this cool thing where you actually turn it one way and you see one thing, and the other way you see, if you rotate your phone, you see somebody else's suggestions. Maybe that's the solution. It's Steven Morris and Azenkot. That actually might solve a problem. It's kind of a cool idea. So in summary, you want to solve the real problem. So what's the problem in this picture? Well, there's a cat and there's a dog, and what's going on? I don't really know. That's the puzzle that you have to figure out. What is the problem? It's not obvious from the picture. That is the question. You have to support flow and usability. And you have to be sure the technical ecosystems are ready. There's no picture here, so you have to imagine your own technology. You get to stick your great computer science research in here. So in conclusion, what will be your breakthrough? Thank you very much. Time for a few questions.
A couple questions, but I'll start with one, and that is, collaborative search, is that a real problem or is that a cherry? Presumably, why is that a real problem?
I don't have the slides for it here, but many people report wanting to search with other people. So say you want to plan a trip with someone else and you're looking for, you know, a hotel, or you're looking for just where to go. And, you know, many, many people say that they're on separate computers looking around. They'd like to share the search results they have so far, but they don't have a good way to do it. Many people, they're looking for a doctor, or they're looking at a medical problem. They want to do it with other people, but there's a lot of friction in that. They research the same things. They find the same links as the other person, and that's annoying. So when you talk to people and you ask them, do you search with other people? They say yes. Would you like it to be more convenient? They say yes. So that's an opportunity to do it better. Yeah, that's why I say that.
At the very beginning, you talked about the 70% and the 80%. Actually, I worry about the 30% and the 20%. Could you talk about those people?
Oh, I should repeat the question. So he said earlier, I talked about what I define success as of if 80% of the people are using the tool and they're, or 70% of people are using the tool and they're happy 80% of the time. And you asked about the other percent and you're concerned about that. I would say what I meant by that is for a given solution, it's working for that percent, but I don't want to exclude other solutions that work for other people as well. So I gave the example of patent examiners, which a tool for them, which is going to be overkill for most people. And I think you're probably alluding to assistive technology that works for, especially for a certain subset of people, although we do know that often things that work for people with disabilities are actually useful for everyone. So I think that's a really important issue that you've brought up. But it's very difficult. It's very rare that a design works for absolutely everyone. So we see with search that tools that, you know, that for children, for example, are very bad at typing. So actually, the incredible progress that's been made on audio interfaces should be a boon for kids, assuming that the speech recognition works better for children's voices than it does today. On the other hand, kids should learn how to spell at some point, so it would be good for them to learn that skill. But audio interfaces are also going to help for people that have physical impairments for typing. So that's something that, as the technology gets better, benefits everybody. Let's see. Another problem is elderly users had a lot of trouble with URLs in search results. They didn't understand them. And in fact, the results show that the less information you put in the surrogate for a search result, the more understandable it was for elderly users. Then, so the question is, should you show that additional information or should you have a special interface for those users? So there's a lot of questions there. It's a hard problem to solve.
My last question is about faceted search specifically. And obviously that's based on metadata, and it seems like the metadata is always wrong. And so any thoughts about interfaces that are robust when the metadata is wrong, faceted interfaces that are robust when the metadata is wrong?
Well, I think if it's a faceted interface and it's relying on the metadata and the metadata is wrong, then I guess it's going to be wrong. I'm not sure that they're always wrong. I think that's when you back it up with good search, though. If the metadata is wrong, you want to have search to fill in the blanks when it's incorrect. Unfortunately, automated tools that try to infer categories tend to produce results that people find are not understandable. And all of those clustering tools that have appeared in the past have disappeared, have died, are dust in the wind, be it Clusty or whatever other one you want to name. They have all disappeared, and there is a reason for that. It's because people do not understand the results. FacetedNet has stayed, and the reason is understandability. So hand curation is, you know, surprisingly more robust than the automated tools, unfortunately. And, you know, letting people indicate when things are wrong, you know, so Yelp makes use of user curation for, usually it's not so much the categories as details about the businesses being wrong. I guess I'm a little more optimistic about the metadata than you are. It seems to be working pretty darn well. Where it doesn't work is for the web as a whole. It's also never worked to show the facets on the web as a whole either. Google had experiments in the past. They had Google Co-op for a while. That's died. It's really never worked for the whole web. It's just too broad. I think it only works in verticals. I don't think it works for all of knowledge. You see, Wikipedia actually has categories, but they're a big mess. They're not organized in any way. They're really not very useful. I think if you've tried to do, I'm sure a lot of people here have tried to do learning with them or models with them. I don't think they're very effective for that because they're really, they're kind of a mess. They're not really organized. People also work a lot with Freebase, which is a really nice structured database, but it's very narrow in what it covers, celebrities and people and some organizations and so on. So I think it's great for what it covers, and it's also hand-curated, but it's very narrow. The major search engines are all trying to build up these really big knowledge collections, knowledge webs, and it'll be really interesting to see what comes of those efforts. They're massive. Yahoo's done it in the past several times. I don't know what their current plans are. It's very tricky to deal with knowledge in the large, and there's, of course, the open knowledge, SCAS, all these efforts that we've all, as AI people, have seen many times. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens over the next few years, this combination of hand-edited and automatically generated knowledge and the linking graphs, to see if it actually succeeds this time. I'll be very interested. I think a lot of people here are experts on this, and I'll be really interested to see what happens over the next few years on that.